Chapter 19. Towards the Millennium. We are at the beginning of a new era, characterized by great insecurity, permanent crisis, and the absence of any kind of status quo. We must realize that we find ourselves in one of those crises of world history which Jacob Burckhardt described. It is no less significant than the one after 1945, even if the initial conditions for surmounting it seem better today. There are no victors and no defeated powers today, not even in Eastern Europe. M. Stürmer in Bergedorf. Although the earthly ideal of socialism-communism has collapsed, the problems it purported to solve remain. The brazen use of social advantage and the inordinate power of money, which often direct the very course of events. And if the global lesson of the 20th century does not serve as a healing inoculation, then the vast red whirlwind may repeat itself in entirety. Alexander Solzhenitsyn in the New York Times, 28th of November, 1993. It is a privilege for a writer to have experienced the end of three states, the Weimar Republic, the fascist state, and the GDR. I don't suppose I'll live long enough to see the end of the Federal Republic. Heine Müller. 1. The short 20th century ended in problems for which nobody had or even claimed to have solutions. As the citizens of the fin de siècle tapped their way through the global fog that surrounded them into the third millennium, all they knew for certain was that an era of history had ended. They knew very little else. Thus, for the first time in two centuries, the world of the 1990s entirely lacked any international system or structure. The very fact that after 1989, dozens of new territorial states appeared without any independent mechanism for determining their borders, without even third parties accepted as sufficiently impartial to act as general mediators, speaks for itself. Where was the consortium of great powers which had once established, or at least formally ratified, disputed frontiers? Where the victors of the First World War, who supervised the redrawing of the map of Europe and the world, fixing a borderline here, insisting on a plebiscite there? Where, indeed, were those working international conferences, so familiar to the diplomats of the past, so different from the brief public relations and photo exercise summits which had now taken their place? What, indeed, were international powers, old or new, at the end of the millennium? The only state left that would have been recognized as a great power in the sense in which the word had been used in 1914 was the USA. What this meant in practice was quite obscure. Russia had been reduced to the size it had been in the mid-17th century. Never since Peter the Great had it been so negligible. Britain and France had been reduced to purely regional status, which was not concealed by the possession of nuclear arms. Germany and Japan were certainly economic great powers, but neither had seen the need to back their enormous economic resources with military muscle in the traditional manner, even when they became free to do so, though nobody knew what they might want to do in the unknown future. What was the international political status of the new European Union, which aspired to a common political policy but proved spectacularly incapable of even pretending to have one, unlike in economic matters? It was not even clear whether all but a few states, large or small, old or young, would exist in their present form by the time the 21st century reached its first quarter. If the nature of the players on the international scene was unclear, so was the nature of the dangers that confronted the world. The short 20th century had been one of world wars, hot or cold, conducted by great powers and their allies, with increasingly apocalyptic scenarios of mass destruction, culminating in the fortunately avoided nuclear holocaust of the superpowers. This danger had clearly disappeared. Whatever the future would bring, the very disappearance or transformation of all but one of the old actors in the world drama meant that a third world war of the old kind was among the least likely prospects. Patently, this did not mean that the age of wars was at an end. The 1980s had already demonstrated, by means of the British-Argentinian War of 1983 and the Iran-Iraq War of 1980 to 1988, that wars which had nothing to do with the global superpower confrontation were a permanent possibility. The years after 1989 saw more military operations in more parts of Europe, Asia, and Africa than anyone could remember, though not all of them were officially classified as wars, in Liberia, Angola, the Sudan and the Horn of Africa, in ex-Yugoslavia, in Moldova, in several countries of the Caucasus and Transcaucasus, in the ever-explosive Middle East, in ex-Soviet Central Asia and Afghanistan. Since it was often not clear who was fighting whom and why in the increasingly frequent situations of national breakdown and disintegration, these activities did not readily fit under any of the classic headings of war, international or civil. Yet the inhabitants of the region concerned could hardly feel themselves to be living in times of peace, especially when, as in Bosnia, Tajikistan or Liberia, they had been living in unquestionable times of peace not so long ago. Besides, as the Balkans in the early 1990s demonstrated, there was no sharp line between regional internecine struggles and a more recognisable war of the old type, into which they could quite easily turn. In short, the global danger of war had not disappeared, it had merely changed. No doubt the inhabitants of stable, strong and favoured states, the European Union as distinct from the adjoining zone of troubles, Scandinavia as distinct from the ex-Soviet shores of the Baltic Sea, might think themselves immune to such insecurity and carnage in the unhappy parts of the Third World and the ex-socialist world, but if they did so, they were mistaken. The crisis in the affairs of the traditional nation-states was enough to make them vulnerable. Quite apart from the possibility that some states might in turn split or break up, a major and not often recognised innovation of the second half of the century weakened them, if only by depriving them of the monopoly of effective force, which had been the criterion of state power in all regions of permanent settlement. This was the democratisation or privatisation of the means of destruction, which transformed the prospect of violence and wreckage anywhere on the globe. It was now possible for quite small groups of political or other dissidents to disrupt and destroy anywhere, as the mainland activities of the IRA in Britain and the attempt to blow up the World Trade Center in New York, 1993, showed. Up to the end of the short century, the costs of these activities, except to insurance companies, were modest, since non-state terrorism, contrary to common assumptions, was much less indiscriminate than the bombardments of official warfare, if only because its aim, where it had one, was mainly political rather than military. Moreover, except for explosive charges, it usually operated with handheld arms more suitable for small-scale killing than for mass murder. However, there was no reason why even nuclear arms, and the material and know-how for their manufacture, all widely available on the world market, could not be adapted for small-group use. Moreover, the democratisation of the means of destruction raised the costs of keeping unofficial violence under control quite dramatically. Thus, the British government, faced with actual combatant forces among the Catholic and Protestant paramilitaries of Northern Ireland of no more than a few hundreds, maintained itself in being in the province by the constant presence of something like 20,000 trained troops, 8,000 armed police, and an expenditure of £3 billion a year. What was true of small rebellions or other forms of domestic violence was even more true of small conflicts outside a country's borders. There were not many international situations in which even quite rich states would be prepared to incur such costs without limit. Several situations in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War dramatized this unexpected limitation on state power, notably Bosnia and Somalia. They also threw light on what looked like becoming perhaps the major cause of international tension in the new millennium, namely that which arose out of the rapidly widening gap between the rich and the poor parts of the world. Each resented the other. The rise of Islamic fundamentalism was patently a movement not only against the ideology of modernization by westernization, but against the West itself. Not by accident did the activists of such movements pursue their ends by disrupting the visits of Western tourists, as in Egypt, or murdering local Western residents in substantial numbers, as in Algeria. Conversely, the most jagged edge of popular xenophobia in the rich countries was directed against foreigners from the Third World, and the European Union dammed its borders against the flood of the Third World's labour-seeking poor. Even within the USA, signs of serious opposition to that country's de facto tolerance of unlimited immigration began to appear. And yet, politically and in military terms, each side lay beyond the power of the other. In almost any conceivable open conflict between states of the North and South, the overwhelming technical superiority and wealth of the North was bound to win, as the Gulf War of 1991 demonstrated conclusively. Even the possession of a few nuclear missiles by some third world country, assuming it also had the means of maintaining and delivering them, was most unlikely to be an effective deterrent, since Western states, as Israel and the Gulf War coalition proved in Iraq, were both ready and able to undertake preemptive strikes against potential enemies too weak to be really threatening as yet. From a military point of view, the First World could safely treat the Third as what Mao had called a paper tiger. Yet it had become increasingly clear over the last half of the short 20th century that the First World could win battles but not wars against the Third, or rather that winning wars, even if possible, could not guarantee control of such territories. The major asset of imperialism had disappeared, namely the readiness of colonial populations once conquered to let themselves be quietly administered by a handful of occupiers. Ruling Bosnia-Herzegovina had been no problem for the Habsburg Empire. But in the early 1990s, all governments were advised by their military advisers that the pacification of that unhappy, war-torn country would require the presence for an indefinite period of several hundreds of thousands of troops, that is to say, a mobilization comparable to that of a major war. Somaliland had always been a difficult colony and had once even briefly required the intervention of a British force headed by a major general, and yet it had not crossed the minds of London or Rome that even Mohammed bin Abdullah, the celebrated Mad Mullah, raised permanently unmanageable problems for the British and Italian colonial governments. Yet in the early 1990s, the USA and the rest of the UN forces of occupation of several tens of thousands withdrew ignominiously when confronted with the option of an indefinite occupation without clear ends. Even the might of the great USA blenched when faced in neighbouring Haiti, a traditional satellite and dependent of Washington, by a local general heading the local American armed and shaped army who refused to allow an elected and reluctantly American-backed president to return and challenged the USA to occupy Haiti. The USA refused to occupy Haiti once again, as it had done from 1915 until 1934, not because the 1,000 or so uniformed thugs of the Haitian army constituted a serious military problem, but because it simply did not know any longer how to settle the Haitian problem by outside force. In short, the century ended in a global disorder whose nature was unclear and without an obvious mechanism for either ending it or keeping it under control. 2. The reason for this impotence lay not only in the genuine profundity and complexity of the world's crisis, but also in the apparent failure of all programs, old and new, for managing or improving the affairs of the human race. The short 20th century had been an era of religious wars, though the most militant and bloodthirsty of its religious were secular ideologies of 19th century vintage, such as socialism and nationalism, whose god equivalents were either abstractions or politicians venerated in the manner of divinities. Probably the extremes of such secular devotion were already in decline even before the end of the Cold War, including the various political cults of personality, or rather they had been reduced from universal churches to a scattering of rival sects. Nevertheless, their strength had lain not so much in their ability to mobilize emotions akin to those of traditional religion, ideological liberalism hardly even tried, but in their promise to provide lasting solutions to the problems of a world in crisis. Yet just this was what they now failed to provide as the century ended. The collapse of the USSR naturally drew attention primarily to the failure of Soviet communism, that is to say, of the attempt to base an entire economy on universal state ownership of the means of production and all-encompassing central planning, without any effective recourse to market or pricing mechanisms. All other historic forms of the socialist ideal had assumed an economy based on the social ownership of all means of production, distribution and exchange, though not necessarily central state ownership, and the elimination of private enterprise and resource allocation by a competitive market. Hence this failure also undermined the aspirations of non-communist socialism, Marxist or otherwise, even though no such regimes or governments had actually claimed to establish socialist economies. Whether, or in which of its forms, Marxism, the intellectual justification and inspiration of communism, would continue, remained a matter of debate. However, clearly, if Marx would live on as a major thinker, which could hardly be doubted, none of the versions of Marxism formulated since the 1890s as doctrines of political action and aspiration for socialist movements were likely to do so in their original forms. On the other hand, the counter-utopia to the Soviet one was also demonstrably bankrupt. This was the theological faith in an economy in which resources were allocated entirely by the totally unrestricted market, under conditions of unlimited competition, a state of affairs believed to produce not only the maximum of goods and services, but also the maximum of happiness, and the only kind of society deserving the name of freedom. No such purely laissez-faire society had ever existed. Unlike the Soviet utopia, fortunately no attempt to institute the ultra-liberal utopia in practice had been made before the 1980s. It had survived most of the short 20th century as a principle for criticizing both the inefficiencies of existing economies and the growth of state power and bureaucracy. The most consistent attempt to do so in the West, Mrs. Thatcher's regime in Britain, whose economic failure was generally admitted by the time of her overthrow, had to operate with a certain gradualism. However, when attempts were made to institute such laissez-faire economies to replace the former Soviet socialist economies at short notice by means of the shock therapies recommended by Western advisers, the results were economically dreadful and both socially and politically disastrous. The theories on which the neoliberal theology was based, while elegant, had little relation to reality. The failure of the Soviet model confirmed supporters of capitalism in their conviction that no economy without a stock exchange could work. The failure of the ultra-liberal model confirmed socialists in the more justified belief that human affairs, including the economy, were too important to be left to the market. It also supported the supposition of skeptical economists that there was no visible correlation between a country's economic success or failure and the distribution of its economic theorists. However, it may well be that the debate which confronted capitalism and socialism as mutually exclusive and polar opposites will be seen by future generations as a relic of the 20th century ideological cold wars of religion. It may turn out to be as irrelevant to the third millennium as the debate between Catholics and various reformers in the 16th and 17th centuries on what constituted true Christianity proved to be in the 18th and 19th. More serious than the evident breakdown of the two polar extremes was the disorientation of what might be called the intermediate or mixed programs and policies which had presided over the most impressive economic miracles of the century. These had pragmatically combined public and private, market and planning, state and business, as the occasion and local ideology warranted. The problem here lay not in the application of some intellectually attractive or impressive theory, whether or not this was defensible in the abstract, for the strength of these programs had been practical success rather than intellectual coherence. It was the erosion of that practical success the crisis decades demonstrated the limitations of the various Golden Age policies, but without as yet generating convincing alternatives. They also revealed the unpredicted but dramatic social and cultural consequences of the era of economic world revolution since 1945, as well as their potentially catastrophic ecological consequences. In short, they revealed that human collective institutions had lost control over the collective consequences of human action. Indeed, one of the intellectual attractions which helps to explain the brief vogue for the neoliberal utopia was precisely that it purported to bypass collective human decisions. Let every individual pursue his or her satisfaction without restraint, and whatever the result was, it was the best that could be achieved. Any alternative course, it was implausibly argued, was worse. If the programmatic ideologies born of the Age of Revolution and the 19th century found themselves at a loss at the end of the 20th century, the most ancient guides to the perplexed of this world, the traditional religions, provided no plausible alternative. The Western ones were in disarray, even in the few countries, headed by that strange anomaly, the USA, where membership of churches and frequent attendance at religious rituals was still habitual. The decline of the various Protestant denominations accelerated. Churches and chapels constructed at the beginning of the century stood empty at its end, or were sold to be used for some other purpose, even in countries like Wales, where they had helped to shape the national identity. From the 1960s on, as we have seen, the decline of Roman Catholicism became precipitous. Even in the ex-communist countries, where the church had enjoyed the advantage of symbolizing opposition to deeply unpopular regimes, the post-communist Catholic sheep showed the same tendency to stray from their shepherd as elsewhere. Religious observers sometimes believed they could detect a return to religion in the post-Soviet region of Orthodox Christianity, but at the end of the century, the evidence for this unlikely, though not impossible, development was not strong. A diminishing number of men and women listened to the various doctrines of these Christian denominations, whatever their merits. The decline and fall of the traditional religions was not compensated, at least in the urban society of the developed world, by the growth of militantly sectarian religion, or by the rise of novel cults and cult communities, still less by the evident desire of so many men and women to take refuge from a world they could neither understand nor control, in a variety of beliefs whose very irrationality constituted their strength. The public visibility of such sects, cults, and beliefs should not distract attention from the relative weakness of their support. Not more than 3-4% of British Jews belonged to any of the ultra-Orthodox sects or groups. Not more than 5% of the US adult population belonged to the militant and missionary sects. In the Third World and on its fringes, the situation was indeed different. Always excepting the vast population of the Far East, whom the Confucian tradition had kept immune to official religion for some millennia, though not to unofficial cults. Here, indeed, one might have expected the religious traditions which constituted popular ways of thinking about the world to become prominent on the public scene as the common people became established actors on that scene. This is what happened in the last decades of the century, as the secularized and modernizing elite minorities who had led their countries into the modern world were marginalized. The appeal of politicized religion was all the greater because the old religions were, almost by definition, enemies to the Western civilization, which was the agent of social disruption, and to the rich and godless countries that looked, more than ever, like the exploiters of the poor world's poverty. That the local targets of such movements were the westernized rich with their Mercedes and emancipated women added a tinge of class struggle to such movements. It became familiarly but misleadingly known as fundamentalism in the West. Whatever the fashionable name, such movements looked back, as it were, ex officio, to some simpler and stabler and more comprehensible age of the imagined past. Since there was no way back to such an era, and since these ideologies could have nothing of relevance to say about the actual problems of societies utterly unlike those of, say, pastoral nomads in the ancient Middle East, they provided no guidance to these problems. They were symptoms of what the Viennese wit Karl Kraus called psychoanalysis, the disease of which they purport to be the cure. This was also the case of the amalgam of slogans and emotions, it can hardly be called an ideology, which flourished on the ruins of the old institutions and ideologies, much in the way weeds had colonized the bombed ruins of European cities after the Second World War bombs fell. This was xenophobia and identity politics. To reject an unacceptable present is not necessarily to formulate, let alone to provide a solution to its problems. Indeed, the closest thing to a political program reflecting such an approach, the Wilsonian-Leninist right to national self-determination for supposedly homogeneous ethnic-linguistic cultural nations, was patently being reduced to a savage and tragic absurdity as the new millennium approached. In the early 1990s, perhaps for the first time, rational observers, irrespective of politics, other than those of some specific group of nationalist activism, began publicly to propose the abandonment of the right of self-determination. Not for the first time, the combination of intellectual nullity with strong, even desperate mass emotion was politically powerful in times of crisis, insecurity, and, over large parts of the globe, disintegrating states and institutions. Like the movements of interwar resentment which had generated fascism, the religio-political protests of the Third World and the hunger for a secure identity and social order in a disintegrating world, the call for community was habitually joined with the call for law and order, provided the humus in which effective political forces could grow. These in turn could overthrow old regimes and become new ones. However, they were no more likely to produce solutions for the new millennium than fascism had been to produce solutions for the age of catastrophe. At the end of the short 20th century, it was not even clear whether they were capable of generating organized national mass movements of the kind which had made some fascisms politically formidable even before they acquired the decisive weapon of state power. Their major asset was probably an immunity to academic economics and the anti-state rhetoric of a liberalism identified with the free market. If politics were to dictate renationalizing an industry, they would not be put off by arguments to the contrary, especially when they could not understand them. And yet, if they were ready to do anything, they knew no more than anyone else what should be done. 3. Neither, of course, does the author of this book. And yet, some long-term tendencies of development were so plain that they allow us to sketch both an agenda of some of the world's major problems and at least some of the conditions for their solution. The two central and, in the long run, decisive problems were demographic and ecological. The world's population, exploding in size since the middle of the 20th century, was generally expected to stabilize at about 10 billion human beings, or five times its 1950 numbers, sometime around 2030, essentially by a decline in the third world's birth rate. If this forecast were to prove wrong, all bets on the future would be off. Even if it proved roughly realistic, it would raise the problem, not hitherto ever faced on a global scale, of how to maintain a stable world population, or more likely, a world population fluctuating round a level or slightly rising or falling trend. A dramatic fall in the global population, improbable but not inconceivable, would introduce yet further complexities. However, stable or not, the predictable movements of the world's population were certain to increase the disequilibria between its different regions. On the whole, as in the short 20th century, the rich and developed countries would be those whose population would be the first to stabilize, or even no longer to reproduce itself, as several such countries in the 1990s no longer did. Surrounded by poor countries with vast armies of the young clamoring for the modest jobs in the rich world which make men and women rich by the standards of El Salvador or Morocco, these countries of many senior citizens and few children would face the choice of allowing massive immigration, which produced political troubles at home, barricading themselves against the immigrants whom they needed, which might be impracticable in the long run, or finding some other formula. The most likely was to permit temporary and conditional immigration, which did not give the foreigners the social and political rights of citizens, that is to say, to create essentially inegalitarian societies. These could range from the societies of frank apartheid, like those of South Africa and Israel, declining in some parts of the world, but by no means excluded in others, to the informal toleration of immigrants who made no claims on the receiving country because they saw it simply as a place in which to earn money from time to time while basically remaining rooted in their own homeland. Later 20th century transport and communications, as well as the enormous gap between the incomes that could be earned in rich and poor countries, made this sort of dual existence more possible than before. Whether it could in the long or even the medium run render the frictions between natives and foreigners less incendiary remains in dispute between the eternal optimists and the illusionless sceptics. There can be little doubt that these frictions will be a major factor in the politics, national or global, of the next decades. The ecological problems, though in the long run decisive, were not so immediately explosive. This is not to underestimate them, even though from the time they entered public consciousness and public debate in the 1970s, they tended to be mistakenly discussed in terms of an imminent apocalypse. However, the fact that the greenhouse effect may not cause the average sea level to rise high enough by the year 2000 to drown all of Bangladesh and the Netherlands, or that the loss of an unknown number of species every day is not unprecedented, was no cause for complacency. A rate of economic growth like that of the second half of the short 20th century, if maintained indefinitely, assuming this to be possible, must have irreversible and catastrophic consequences for the natural environment of this planet, including the human race which is part of it. It will not destroy the planet or make it absolutely uninhabitable, but it will certainly change the pattern of life on the biosphere and may well make it uninhabitable by the human species as we know it in anything like its present numbers. Moreover, the rate at which modern technology has increased the capacity of our species to transform the environment is such that even if we assume that it does not accelerate, the time available to deal with the problem must be measured in decades rather than centuries. About the answer to this approaching ecological crisis, only three things can be said with reasonable certainty. First, that it must be global rather than local, even though clearly more time would be gained if the greatest single source of global pollution, the 4% of the world's population who inhabit the USA, were to be charged a realistic price for the petrol they consume. Second, that the objective of ecological policy must be both radical and realistic. Market solutions, that is to say, including the costs of environmental externalities in the price consumers pay for their goods and services, are neither. As the example of the USA shows, even a modest attempt to raise an energy tax in that country can raise insuperable political difficulties. The record of oil prices since 1973 proves that, in a free market society, the effect of multiplying energy costs 12 to 15-fold in 6 years was not to diminish energy use, but to make it more efficient, while encouraging massive investment in new and environmentally dubious sources of irreplaceable fossil fuel. These in turn would lower the price again and encourage more wasteful use. On the other hand, proposals like a world of zero growth, let alone fantasies like a return to the alleged primitive symbiosis between man and nature, while radical, were completely impracticable. Zero growth under existing conditions would freeze the present inequalities between the world's countries, a situation more tolerable to the average inhabitant of Switzerland than to the average inhabitant of India. It is no accident that the main support for ecological policies comes from the rich countries and from the comfortable rich and middle classes in all countries, except for businessmen who hope to make money by polluting activities. The poor, multiplying, and underemployed want more development, not less. Yet, rich or not, the supporters of ecological policies were right. The rate of development must be reduced to what was sustainable in the medium run. The term was conveniently meaningless, and in the long run, a balance would have to be struck between humanity, the renewable resources it consumed, and the effect of its activities on the environment. Nobody knew, and few dared to speculate, how this was to be done, and at what level of population, technology, and consumption such a permanent balance would be possible. Scientific expertise could no doubt establish what needed to be done to avoid an irreversible crisis, but the problem of establishing such a balance was not one of science and technology, but political and social. One thing, however, was undeniable. It would be incompatible with a world economy based on the unlimited pursuit of profit by economic enterprises, dedicated by definition to this object, and competing with each other in a global free market. From the environmental point of view, if humanity was to have a future, the capitalism of the crisis decades could have none. 4. Considered in isolation, the problems of the world economy were, with one exception, less serious. Even left to itself, it would continue to grow. If there was anything in the Kondratiev periodicity, it was due to enter another era of prosperous expansion before the end of the millennium, although this might be hampered for a while by the aftereffects of the disintegration of Soviet socialism, by the collapse of parts of the world into anarchy and warfare, and perhaps by an excessive dedication to global free trade, about which economists tend to be more starry-eyed than economic historians. Nevertheless, the scope for expansion was enormous. The Golden Age, as we have seen, was primarily the great leap forward of the developed market economies, perhaps 20 countries inhabited by about 600 million, 1960. Globalization and the international redistribution of production would continue to bring most of the rest of the world's 6,000 million into the global economy. Even congenital pessimists had to admit that this was an encouraging prospect for business. The major exception was the, apparently irreversible, widening of the chasm between the rich and poor countries of the world, a process somewhat accelerated by the disastrous impact of the 1980s in much of the Third World and the pauperization of many ex-socialist countries. Short of a spectacular fall in the growth rate of the Third World population, the gap looked like continuing to widen. The belief, following neoclassical economics, that unrestricted international trade would allow the poorer countries to come closer to the rich runs counter to historical experience as well as common sense. A world economy developing by the generation of such growing inequalities was, almost inevitably, accumulating future troubles. However, in any case, economic activities do not and cannot exist in isolation from their context and consequences, As we have seen, three aspects of the late 20th century world economy gave cause for alarm. First, technology continued to squeeze human labour out of the production of goods and services without providing either enough work of the same kind for those it jettisoned or the guarantee of a rate of economic growth sufficient to absorb them. Very few observers seriously expected even a temporary return to the full employment of the Golden Age in the West. Second, while labour remained a major factor of production, the globalisation of the economy shifted industry from its old centres in the rich countries with high-cost labour to countries whose main advantage, other things being equal, was cheap hands and heads. One or both of two consequences must follow. The transfer of jobs from high-wage to low-wage regions and, on free market principles, the fall of wages in high-wage regions under the pressure of global wage competition. Old industrial countries like Britain could therefore move in the direction of becoming cheap labour economies themselves, though with socially explosive results and unlikely to compete on this basis with the NICs. Historically, such pressures had been countered by state action, for example by protectionism. However, and this was the third worrying aspect of the fin de siècle world economy, its triumph and that of a pure free market ideology weakened or even removed most instruments for managing the social effects of economic upheavals. The world economy was an increasingly powerful and uncontrolled engine. Could it be controlled, and if so, by whom? This raised both economic and social problems, though obviously far more immediately troubling ones in some countries, for example Britain, than in others, for example South Korea. The economic miracles of the Golden Age had rested on rising real incomes in the developed market economies, for mass consumption economies need mass consumers with enough income for high-technology consumer durables. Most of these incomes had been earned as wages in high-wage labour markets. These were now at risk, though mass consumers were more essential to the economy than ever. Of course, in the rich countries, the mass market had been stabilised by the shift of labour from industry to tertiary occupations, which had in general much stabler employment, and by the vast growth in transfer incomes, mostly social security and welfare. These represented something like 30% of the joint GNP of the Western developed countries in the late 1980s. In the 1920s, they had probably stood at less than 4% of GNP. This may well explain why the Wall Street Stock Exchange collapse of 1987, the largest since 1929, did not lead to a world capitalist slump like that of the 1930s. However, precisely these two stabilizers were now being undermined. As the short 20th century ended, Western governments and economic orthodoxy agreed that the cost of public social security and welfare was too high and must be reduced, and mass reduction of employment in the hitherto stablest sectors of tertiary occupations, public employment, banking and finance, the technologically redundant mass office work, became common. These were not immediate dangers to the global economy so long as the relative decline in the old markets was compensated by expansion in the rest of the world, or so long as the global number of those with rising real incomes grew faster than the rest. To put it brutally, if the global economy could discard a minority of poor countries as economically uninteresting and irrelevant, it could also do so with the very poor within the borders of any and all its countries, so long as the number of potentially interesting consumers was sufficiently large. Seen from the impersonal heights from which business economists and corporate accountants survey the scene, who needed the 10% of the US population whose real hourly earnings since 1979 had fallen by up to 16%? Again, taking the global perspective, which is implicit in the model of economic liberalism, inequalities of development are irrelevant unless it can be shown that they produce globally more negative than positive results. From this point of view, there is no economic reason why, if comparative costs say so, France should not shut down its entire agriculture and import all its foodstuffs, or why, if this were technically possible as well as cost-effective, all the world's TV programmes should not be made in Mexico City. However, this is not a view that can be held without reservations by those who live in the national economy as well as in the global one. That is to say, by all national governments and most of the inhabitants of their countries, not least because we cannot avoid the social and political consequences of worldwide upheavals. Whatever the nature of these problems, an unrestricted and uncontrolled global free market economy could provide no solution for them. If anything, it was likely to make developments such as the growth of permanent unemployment and underemployment worse, since the rational choice of profit-making businesses was A, to cut down the number of its employees as much as possible, human beings being more expensive than computers, and B, to cut down Social Security or any other taxes as far as possible. Nor was there any good reason to suppose that the global free market economy would solve them. Until the 1970s, national and world capitalism had never operated under such conditions, or if they had, had not necessarily benefited. For the 19th century, it is at least arguable that, contrary to the classical model, free trade coincided with and was probably the main cause of depression, and protectionism was probably the main cause of development for most of today's developed countries. As for the 20th century, its economic miracles were not achieved by laissez-faire, but against it. It was therefore likely that the fashion for economic liberalisation and marketisation, which had dominated the 1980s and reached a peak of ideological complacency after the collapse of the Soviet system, would not last long. The combination of the world crisis of the early 1990s and the spectacular failure of such policies when applied as shock therapy in the ex-socialist countries already caused second thoughts among some former enthusiasts. Who would have expected economic consultants in 1993 to announce perhaps Marx was right after all? However, two major obstacles stood in the way of a return to realism. The first was the absence of a credible political threat to the system, such as communism and the existence of the USSR, or, in a different way, the Nazi conquest of Germany had once seemed to be. These, as this book has tried to show, had provided the incentive for capitalism to reform itself. The collapse of the USSR, the decline and fragmentation of the working class and its movements, the military insignificance in conventional war of the Third World, the reduction of the really poor in the developed countries to a minority underclass, all these diminished the incentive for reform. Nevertheless, the rise of movements of the ultra-right and the unexpected revival of support for the heirs of the old regime in the ex-communist countries were warning signals, and by the early 1990s, once again, seemed to be such. The second was the very process of globalization, reinforced by the dismantling of the national mechanisms for protecting the victims of the free global economy from the social costs of what was proudly described as the system of wealth creation, now everywhere regarded as the most effective that humanity has yet devised. For as the same editorial of the Financial Times, 24/12/93, admitted, it remains, however, an imperfect force. About two-thirds of the world's population have gained little or no substantial advantage from rapid economic growth. In the developed world, the lowest quartile of income earners have witnessed trickle-up rather than trickle-down. As the millennium approached, it became increasingly evident that the central task of the time was not to gloat over the corpse of Soviet communism, but to consider once again the built-in defects of capitalism. What changes in the system would their removal require? Would it still be the same after their removal? For, as Joseph Schumpeter had observed apropos of the cyclical fluctuations of the capitalist economy, they are not, like tonsils, separate things that can be treated by themselves, but are, like the beat of the heart, of the essence of the organism that displays them. 5. The immediate reaction of Western commentators to the collapse of the Soviet system was that it ratified the permanent triumph of both capitalism and liberal democracy, two concepts which the less sophisticated of North American world watchers tended to confuse. Though capitalism was certainly not in the best shape at the end of the short 20th century, Soviet-type communism was unquestionably dead and quite unlikely to revive. On the other hand, no serious observer in the early 1990s could be as sanguine about liberal democracy as about capitalism. The most that could be predicted with some confidence, except perhaps for the more divinely inspired fundamentalist regimes, was that practically all states would continue to declare their profound attachment to democracy, organize elections of some kind, with some toleration for a sometimes notional opposition, while putting their own gloss on the meaning of the term. Indeed, the most obvious thing about the political situation of the world states was its instability. In most of them, the chances of survival for the existing regime over the next 10 or 15 years were, on the most optimistic calculation, not good. Even where countries had a relatively predictable system of government, as for instance Canada, Belgium or Spain, their existence as single states in 10 or 15 years might be uncertain, and consequently so would be the nature of their possible successor regimes, if any. In short, politics was not a field that encouraged futurology. Nevertheless, some features of the global political landscape stood out. The first, as already noted, was the weakening of the nation-state, the central institution of politics since the age of revolution, both by virtue of its monopoly of public power and law and because it constituted the effective field of political action for most purposes. The nation-state was eroded in two ways, from above and below. It was rapidly losing power and function to various supranational entities, and indeed, absolutely, inasmuch as the disintegration of large states and empires produced a multiplicity of smaller ones, too weak to defend themselves in an era of international anarchy. It was also, as we have seen, losing its monopoly of effective power and its historic privileges within its borders, as witnessed the rise of private security or protection and the rise of private courier services to compete with the post, hitherto virtually everywhere managed by a state ministry. These developments did not make the state either redundant or ineffective. Indeed, in some respects, its capacity to monitor and control the affairs of its citizens was reinforced by technology, since virtually all their financial and administrative transactions, other than small cash payments, were now likely to be recorded by some computer, and all their communications, except for most face-to-face conversations in the open air, could now be intercepted and recorded. And yet, its posture had changed. From the 18th century until the second half of the 20th, the nation-state had extended its range, powers and functions almost continuously. This was an essential aspect of modernization. Whether governments were liberal, conservative, social democratic, fascist or communist, at the peak of this trend, the parameters of citizens' lives in modern states were almost exclusively determined, except during interstate conflict, by the activities or inactivities of that state. Even the impact of global forces, such as world economic booms and slumps, came to them filtered through their state's policy and institutions. By the end of the century, the nation-state was on the defensive against a world economy it could not control, against the institutions it had constructed to remedy its own international weakness, such as the European Union, against its apparent financial incapacity to maintain the services to its citizens so confidently undertaken a few decades ago, against its real incapacity to maintain what, by its own criteria, was its major function, the maintenance of public law and order. The very fact that, during the era of its rise, the state had taken over and centralized so many functions and set itself such ambitious standards of public order and control made its inability to maintain them doubly painful. And yet, the state, or some other form of public authority representing the public interest, was more indispensable than ever if the social and environmental iniquities of the market economy were to be countered, or even, as the reform of capitalism in the 1940s had shown, if the economic system was to operate satisfactorily. Without some state allocation and redistribution of the national income, what, for instance, would happen to the peoples of the old developed countries whose economy rested on a relatively shrinking foundation of income earners, squeezed between the rising numbers of those not needed for labour by the high-tech economy and a swelling proportion of the non-earning old? It was absurd to argue that the citizens of the European community, whose per capita share of the joint national income had increased by 80% from 1970 to 1990, could not afford the level of income and welfare in 1990 that had been taken for granted in 1970. But these could not exist without the state. Suppose, the scenario is not utterly fantastic, present trends continued and led to economies in which one quarter of the population worked gainfully and three quarters did not. But after 20 years, the economy produced a national income per capita twice as large as before. Who except public authority would and could ensure a minimum of income and welfare for all? Who could counter the tendencies to inequality so strikingly visible in the crisis decades? To judge by the experience of the 1970s and 1980s, not the free market. If these decades proved anything, it was that the major political problem of the world, and certainly of the developed world, was not how to multiply the wealth of nations, but how to distribute it for the benefit of their inhabitants. This was so even in poor developing countries, which needed more economic growth. Brazil, a monument to social neglect, had a GNP per capita almost 2.5 times as large as Sri Lanka in 1939 and over 6 times as large at the end of the 1980s. In Sri Lanka, which had subsidized basic foodstuffs and given free education and health care until the later 1970s, the average newborn could expect to live several years longer than the average Brazilian and to die as an infant at about half the Brazilian rate in 1969, at a third of the Brazilian rate in 1989. The percentage of illiteracy in 1989 was almost twice as great in Brazil as on the Asian island. Social distribution and not growth would dominate the politics of the new millennium. Non-market allocation of resources, or at least a ruthless limitation of market allocation, was essential to head off the impending ecological crisis. One way or another, the fate of humanity in the new millennium would depend on the restoration of public authorities. 6. This leaves us with a double problem. What would be the nature and scope of the decision-making authorities? Supranational, national, subnational, and global, alone or in combination? What would be their relation to the people about whom these decisions are made? The first was, in a sense, a technical question, since the authorities were already in existence, and in principle, though by no means in practice, so were the models of the relationship between them. The expanding European Union provided plenty of relevant material, even if the specific proposal for dividing labour between global, supranational, national and subnational authorities was likely to be bitterly resented by someone or other. The existing global authorities were no doubt too specialised in their functions, though they tried to extend their range by imposing political and ecological policies on countries that needed to borrow money. The European Union stood alone and, being the child of a specific and probably unrepeatable historical conjuncture, was likely to remain alone unless something similar was to be reconstituted from the fragments of the former USSR. The pace at which supranational decision-making would advance could not be predicted. Nevertheless, it would certainly advance, and one could see how it might operate. It operated already through the global bank managers of the great international lending agencies, representing the joint resources of the oligarchy of the richest countries, which also happened to include the most powerful ones. As the gap between the rich and poor grew, the scope for exercising such global power looked like increasing. The trouble was that since the 1970s, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, politically backed by the USA, had pursued a policy systematically favouring free market orthodoxy, private enterprise and global free trade, which suited the late 20th century US economy as well as it had the mid-19th century British one, but not necessarily the world. If global decision-making was to realise its potential, such policies would have to be changed. This did not look like an immediate prospect. The second problem was not technical at all. It arose out of the dilemma of a world committed at the end of the century to a particular brand of political democracy, but also faced with policy problems, to which the election of presidents and pluri-party assemblies were irrelevant, even when it did not complicate their solutions. More generally, it was the dilemma of the role of the common people in what had been called, correctly, at least by pre-feminist standards, the century of the common man. It was the dilemma of an age when government could, some would say must, be of the people and for the people, but could not in any operational sense be by the people, or even by representative assemblies elected among those who competed for its vote. The dilemma was not new. The difficulties of democratic politics, discussed for the interwar years in an earlier chapter, had been familiar to political scientists and satirists since the politics of universal suffrage became more than a peculiarity of the USA. The democratic predicament was more acute now, both because public opinion, monitored by polls, magnified by the omnipresent media, was now constantly inescapable, and because public authorities had to take far more decisions to which public opinion was no sort of guide. Often they might have to be decisions which might well be opposed by the majority of the electorate, each voter disliking their prospective effect on his or her private affairs, though perhaps believing them to be desirable in the general interest. Thus, at the end of the century, politicians in some democratic countries had come to the conclusion that any proposal to raise taxes for any purpose meant electoral suicide. Elections, therefore, became contests in fiscal perjury. At the same time, voters and parliaments were constantly faced with decisions on matters about which non-experts, that is to say, the vast majority both of the electors and the elected, had no qualifications to express an opinion, for instance, the future of the nuclear industry. There had been moments, even in democratic states, when the citizen body was so identified with the purposes of a government enjoying legitimacy and public trust that a sense of the common interest prevailed, as in Britain during the Second World War. There had been other situations which made possible a basic consensus between the main political rivals, once again leaving governments free to pursue the general aims of policies about which there was no major disagreement. As we have seen, this was the case in a number of Western countries during the Golden Age. Governments had also, often enough, been able to rely on a consensus of peer judgment among their technical and scientific advisers, indispensable to administrations of laymen. When they spoke with the same voice, or at any rate their consensus overrode dissidence, policy controversy narrowed. It is when they do not that lay decision-makers grope through darkness, like juries faced with rival psychologists called by prosecution and defence, neither of whom there is strong reason to believe. But as we have seen, the crisis decades had undermined political consensus and generally accepted truths in intellectual matters, especially in fields with a bearing on policy. As for undivided peoples firmly identified with their governments, or the other way round, they were thin on the ground in the 1990s. True, there were still many countries whose citizens accepted the idea of a strong, active and socially responsible state that deserved some freedom of action because it served the common welfare. Unfortunately, the actual governments of the fin de siècle rarely looked like this ideal. As for the countries in which government as such was suspect, they were those which modelled themselves on the USA's pattern of individualistic anarchism tempered by litigation and pork-barrel politics, and the much more numerous ones where the state was so weak or so corrupt that citizens did not expect it to produce any public good at all. These were common in parts of the Third World, but, as Italy in the 1980s showed, not unknown in the First. Hence, the most untroubled decision-makers were those who escaped democratic politics altogether, private corporations, supranational authorities, and, of course, non-democratic regimes. Within democratic systems, it was not so easy to shelter decision-making from politicians, although central banks were removed from their grasp in some countries, and conventional wisdom wanted this example followed elsewhere. Increasingly, however, governments took to bypassing both the electorate and its representative assemblies, if possible, or at least to take decisions first and then challenging both to reverse a fait accompli, relying on the volatility, divisions or inertness of public opinion. Politics increasingly became an exercise in evasion, as politicians were afraid to tell voters what they did not want to hear. After the end of the Cold War, unavowable actions were no longer so easily hidden behind the iron curtain of national security. Almost certainly this strategy of evasion would continue to gain ground. Even in democratic countries, more and more decision-making bodies would be withdrawn from electoral control, except in the most indirect sense that the governments which appointed such bodies had themselves at one time been elected. Centralising governments, such as those of Britain in the 1980s and early 1990s, were particularly inclined to multiply such ad hoc authorities not answering to an electorate and nicknamed quangos. Even countries without an effective division of powers found this tacit demotion of democracy convenient. In countries like the USA, it was indispensable, since the built-in conflict between executive and legislature made it almost impossible to take decisions under normal circumstances, except behind the scenes. By the century's end, large numbers of citizens were withdrawing from politics, leaving the affairs of state to the political class, the phrase seems to have originated in Italy, who read each other's speeches and editorials, a special interest group of professional politicians, journalists, lobbyists and others whose occupations ranked at the bottom of the scale of trustworthiness in sociological inquiries. For many people, the political process was irrelevant, or merely something that affected their personal lives favourably or not. on the one hand, wealth, the privatization of life and entertainment, and consumer egoism made politics less important and less attractive. On the other hand, those who reckoned to get little out of elections turned their backs on them. Between 1960 and 1988, the proportion of blue-collar workers who cast their vote in American presidential elections fell by one-third. The decline of the organized mass parties, class-based, ideological, or both, eliminated the major social engine for turning men and women into politically active citizens. For most people, even the collective identification with their country now came more easily through the national sports teams and non-political symbols than through the institutions of the state. One might have supposed that depoliticization would leave the authorities freer to take decisions. In fact, it had the opposite effect. The minorities which went on campaigning, sometimes for specific issues of public interest, more often for some sectional interest, could interfere with the smooth process of government just as effectively, perhaps even more effectively, than all-purpose political parties, since, unlike these, each pressure group could concentrate its energy on pursuing a single objective. Moreover, the increasingly systematic tendency of governments to sidestep the electoral process magnified the political function of the mass media, which now reached into every household, providing by far the most powerful means of communication from the public sphere to the private men, women, and children. Their capacity to discover and publish what authority wished to keep quiet and to give expression to public feelings which were not or could no longer be articulated by the formal mechanisms of democracy made them into major actors on the public scene. Politicians used them and were frightened of them. Technical progress made them increasingly difficult to control, even in highly authoritarian countries. The decline of state power made them harder to monopolize in non-authoritarian ones. As the century ended, it became evident that the media were a more important component of the political process than parties and electoral systems, and likely to remain so unless politics took a sharp turn away from democracy. However, while they were enormously powerful as a counterweight to government secrecy, they were in no sense a means of democratic government. Neither the media nor assemblies elected by the politics of universal suffrage nor the people itself could actually govern in any realistic sense of the word. On the other hand, government or any analogous form of public decision-making could no longer govern against the people or even without it, any more than the people could live without or against government. For better or worse, in the 20th century, the common people entered history as actors in their own collective right. Every regime except theocracy now derived its authority from them, even those who terrorized and killed their citizens on a large scale. The very concept of what it was once fashionable to call totalitarianism implied populism, for if it did not matter what the people thought about those who ruled in its name, why bother to make them think the thoughts deemed appropriate by their rulers? Governments which derived their authority from the unquestioning obedience to some divinity, to tradition, or from the deference of lower to higher ranks in a hierarchical society were on the way out. Even Islamic fundamentalism, the most flourishing brand of theocracy, advanced not by the will of Allah but by the mass mobilization of the common people against unpopular governments. Whether the people had the right to elect its government or not, its interventions in public affairs, active or passive, were decisive. Indeed, just because the 20th century had plenty of examples of incomparably ruthless regimes, and those seeking to impose minority power on majorities by force, as in apartheid South Africa, it demonstrated the limits of sheer coercive power. Even the most ruthless and brutal rulers were well aware that unlimited power alone could not supplant the political assets and skills of authority, a public sense of the regime's legitimacy, a degree of active popular support, the ability to divide and rule, and, especially in times of crisis, the citizens' willing obedience. When, as in 1989, this obedience was visibly withdrawn from Eastern European regimes, these regimes abdicated, even though they still had the full backing of their civil functionaries, armed forces and security services. In short, contrary to appearances, the 20th century showed that one can rule against all the people for some of the time, some of the people all of the time, but not all of the people all of the time. Admittedly, this was no comfort to permanently oppressed minorities or to peoples who suffered during a generation or more of virtually universal oppression. Yet all this did not answer the question what the relation between decision-makers and peoples should be. It merely underlined the difficulty of the answer. The policies of authorities had to take account of what people, or at least majorities of citizens, wanted or did not want, even if it was not their purpose to reflect popular wishes. At the same time, they could not govern simply on the basis of asking them. Moreover, unpopular decisions were harder to impose on masses than on power groups. It was far easier to impose mandatory standards of emission on a few giant auto producers than to persuade millions of motorists to halve their petrol consumption. Every European government discovered that the results of leaving the future of the European community to popular votes were unfavourable or at best unpredictable. Every serious observer knew that many of the policy decisions that would have to be taken in the early 21st century would be unpopular. Perhaps another tension-relaxing era of general prosperity and improvement, like the Golden Age, would soften the citizens' mood, but neither a return to the 1960s nor a relaxation of the social and cultural insecurities and tensions of the crisis decades were to be expected. If voting by universal suffrage remained the general rule, as was probable, there seemed to be two main options. Where decision-making was not already outside politics, it would increasingly sidestep the electoral process, or rather the constant monitoring of government inseparable from it. Authorities which had themselves to be elected would also increasingly hide, octopus-like, behind clouds of obfuscation to confuse their electorates. The other option was to recreate the sort of consensus which allowed authorities substantial freedom of action, at least so long as the bulk of citizens did not feel too much cause for discontent. An old established political model for this had been available since Napoleon III in the mid-19th century, the democratic election of a saviour of the people or a nation-saving regime, that is to say, plebiscitary democracy. Such a regime might or might not have come to power constitutionally, but if ratified by a reasonably honest election with a choice of rival candidates and some voice for an opposition, it satisfied the fin de siècle criteria of democratic legitimacy. But it offered no encouraging prospect for the future of parliamentary democracy of the liberal kind. 7. What I have written cannot tell us whether and how humanity can solve problems it faces at the end of the millennium. Perhaps it can help us understand what these problems are and what the conditions for their solution must be, but not how far these conditions are present or in the process of coming into being. It can tell us how little we know and how extraordinarily poor has been the understanding of men and women who took the major public decisions in the century. How little of what happened, especially in the second half of that century, was expected and still less predicted by them. It can confirm what many have always suspected, that history, among many other and more important things, is the record of the crimes and follies of mankind. It is no help to prophecy. So it would be foolish to end this book with predictions of what a landscape will look like which has already been left unrecognizable by the tectonic upheavals of the short 20th century and will be left even more unrecognizable by those which are even now taking place. There is less reason to feel hopeful about the future than in the middle 1980s, when the present author concluded his trilogy on the history of the long 19th century, 1789 to 1914, with the words, "The evidence that the world in the 21st century will be better is not negligible. If the world succeeds in not destroying itself, that is to say by nuclear war, the probability will be quite strong." Nevertheless, even a historian whose age precludes him from expecting dramatic changes for the better in what remains of his lifetime cannot reasonably deny the possibility that in another quarter or half century things may look more promising. In any case, it is highly likely that the present phase of post-Cold War breakdown will be temporary, even though it already looks like lasting rather longer than the phases of breakdown and disruption which followed the two hot world wars. However, hopes or fears are not predictions. We know that behind the opaque cloud of our ignorance and the uncertainty of detailed outcomes, the historical forces that shaped the century are continuing to operate. We live in a world captured, uprooted, and transformed by the titanic economic and techno-scientific process of the development of capitalism, which has dominated the past two or three centuries. We know, or at least it is reasonable to suppose, that it cannot go on ad infinitum. The future cannot be a continuation of the past, and there are signs, both externally and, as it were, internally, that we have reached a point of historic crisis. The forces generated by the techno-scientific economy are now great enough to destroy the environment, that is to say, the material foundations of human life, the structures of human societies themselves, including even some of the social foundations of the capitalist economy, are on the point of being destroyed by the erosion of what we have inherited from the human past. Our world risks both explosion and implosion. It must change. We do not know where we are going. We only know that history has brought us to this point and, if readers share the argument of this book, why? However, one thing is plain. If humanity is to have a recognizable future, it cannot be by prolonging the past or the present. If we try to build the third millennium on that basis, we shall fail. And the price of failure, that is to say, the alternative to a changed society, is darkness.
This concludes The Age of Extremes by Eric Hobsbawm, narrated by Hugh Kermode. Copyright 1994 by the trustees of the Eric Hobsbawm Literary Estate. Production copyright 2020 by Archet Audio. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with the trustees of the Eric Hobsbawm Literary Estate, care of David Higham Associates, and was produced in the year 2020 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.